The Southerners are like, oh my God, what did we elect? What is this guy?
Right.
Like, we got, this is like electing John Quincy Adams. What the hell happened?
Hello and welcome back to The Buck Starts Here, a podcast that digs deep into the juicy stories, power plays, and wild twists that shape the presidencies of the United States. I'm Kyle, the Fred Noonan to Eric's Earhart. Today we're going to really shine a spotlight on Mr. Taylor's presidency, because we really want to talk about the Mexican-American War, but first we have to do this one, so you're going to have to sit with us for hopefully a shorter episode than the last one.
Yeah, this is, unfortunately, this is where Zachary Taylor really gains a lot of momentum, if I'm being honest, for, was he actually a good guy? Like, you're going to be, when we talk about his stances during, not just during his presidency, mm-hmm. it reads really weird, because again, there's always that shadow of slavery,
right? But right.
To hear his stances during his presidency, unbelievable.
What really?
He sounds more like John Quincy Adams than he does Andrew Jackson.
No kidding.
Who
is he running under? Is he a Whig or is he?
So he's a Whig. And he's a weird Whig. I think he struggled. I don't think he ever wanted to be. I don't think he ever wanted to be categorized as a politician, if I'm being honest with you. Like, I think he was more, I think he was his own thing. So he never really starts thinking about politics until after the 5 years he spent retired between the end of the Seminole Wars, I should say the purchase of Cypress Grove, to him entering the Mexican-American War.
Does that have anything to do with his wife wanting him to settle down and maybe stop being, running around as Major Rough and Ready?
Yeah, it is funny because his wife definitely loved him for him, like right. Really, really did. Right. But even I think she was like, you're done.
It's been 40 years. Like, please.
40 years. So, he really first started, we start understanding his political views publicly in 1841. So he's never really been openly public about his political leanings because he believed it was beneath an officer to discuss political leanings. He really believed that. But it slowly starts coming out that he actually holds very strong Whig tendencies, and he's a man from Kentucky who opposed a lot of the policies of Andrew Jackson and Martin Van Buren. He actually just straight up was like, "You guys caused the Panic of 1837."
Oh, so people, good.
Oh yeah,
somebody admitted it,
and people are like, "Well, are you sure?" He's like, "Yeah, no, it was those guys. It was."
Clearly the ones who were the terrorists of abomination. Like,
yeah. I do like the idea that of this like very competent military general who can lead men into essentially what's like being on another planet at this point. And he's got to be seen as incredibly logical and straightforward. He's like, no, it's those guys' fault. Like, no, we're all, right. I have no political points to gain here. It's just those guys.
It's very clear.
So he also blames them for weakening the military. He had a big thing about, the way, one, when you hurt the, he had this idea of like, when you hurt the economy, you hurt the military. But he didn't like how like the military was policing the frontier, but being intentionally provocative, because he made all this success by enforcing these treaties, like not letting white settlers take native lands and vice versa. And he was like, he didn't like this idea of rejection of treaties. That kind of blew his mind a little bit. He's like, wait a minute. Like, he also didn't like the idea like you have a treaty to stop bloodshed, and now you're violating the treaty and you're causing bloodshed. And those are my men you're causing to bleed. I don't like that. Like, right. What are you doing?
Right.
And he ends up getting kind of like national recognition for this accidentally. He kind of like goes viral for these like incredibly what I would think would be moderate stances on stuff. And you're coming off the quote unquote.
Just like the populist run of.
Yeah, the corrupt bargain, the populist run of Jacksonianism. And then you got this guy who's just like, hey, what if we just like logically look at stuff? And how about that? he ends up coming out in favor. He's not like endorsing people, but when people are asking him, he's talking about how much he admires William Henry Harrison, who was, you know, this general he was so lucky to serve under in the War of 1812, and how Harrison was this brilliant tactician who would win battles before they were fought. And like, you know, anybody who thinks like that's going to make this, is going to be this great president. Harrison wins. Harrison wins the presidency. And you know, he's very excited about that. So Harrison wins in 1841, and even though it's it you know, even though he's a short-lived president, literally, figuratively, right. Taylor's like, oh, wow, you know, maybe there's something about these great military men, these leaders. Maybe there's a place in politics for us. Because before that, in terms of military men, you obviously had Washington as a general.
Monroe.
But your next general was Jackson. So in his lifetime, I mean, he was born in 1784, so he probably doesn't super remember Washington being president. He's only seen Jackson. So he's like, well, should generals be here? Because he didn't like Jackson. It is interesting because, like, Jackson, the second Seminole War broke out. There was no third Seminole War after Taylor got involved.
I know. ruthless efficiency, I think we termed it.
So he ends up becoming this. Sometimes it's described as a Whiggish outlook, where he favors like strong congressional authority over executive power. You know, he likes this cautious approach to westward expansion. Like, you know, we shouldn't be just taking massive swaths of land. Let's do this procedurally. Almost like a man who's fought out there and is like, oh, maybe we don't just pretend this is going to be easy to do. he never leaves active duty during this time, by the way. Like, he's still there.
Really?
Because he couldn't bring himself to do it again. He's effectively retired, but he just couldn't bring himself to do it. Nobody's going to force him to retire.
It's because he knows that if he actually hangs it up again, there's no re-enlisting. At this point, you can reenlist at 32 or 28 or whatever he was the first time. But you're not doing that at 60.
but here's something interesting. Up until 1841, never voted.
What?
Yeah. You never voted.
I never voted until 1841 either.
Yeah, right. but I just think that that's super interesting. So as, you know, he gets ready to start ramping up, right? We have the war of... we have the Mexican-American War. Like, you know, we're going to be doing a show on it.
Oh, no, a full episode.
He comes back in December of 1847. So, like, December of 1847, the election's in 1848. For the record, this isn't even a year away.
That quick he was?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's right. Wow. Unfortunately, this is going to be a shorter episode. So he comes home. It's a hero's welcoming.
There's not a whole lot of lead up.
Yeah. So he comes home in 1847. General Scott had just captured Mexico City. General Taylor was basically ordered to bring his remaining troops home. So he returns to the United States. And he's really the first person to return, first for the Army, that happened in the Navy, but to return home from a foreign war. So he returns home in December 1847.
Oh, wow. It is our first foreign war, isn't it?
Like, yeah. Is that wild?
First war we fought on foreign country? Yeah, I guess there's a little bit.
I mean, we did have some people who could do border incursions,
maybe a little bit too, right?
Yeah, but those weren't sustained campaigns like what happened in the Mexican-American War.
No, I guess technically what we're doing in Florida was overthrowing Spanish governors, so maybe that was a little bit foreign too.
yeah, I guess you could. Yeah, okay. Maybe. I'm not against that interpretation, but is it a campaign if the guy just goes crazy?
Yeah.
I don't know if that counts. This is a declared war. This is a declared war.
Yes. So can he declare war? Can the general declare war?
Yeah. This is war crimes. Right. Like, so after 2 years away, he's pumped. He's home. He makes it back to Cypress Plantation. He's he writes about being like joyfully reunited with his wife. He's like, oh, this is awesome. Like, to him, he's like, wow, I did it. Like, I had all these cool achievements before, but I'm a general. I'm a brigadier general. I went there and I won a war. Like, he won it. Like, he won. Was not something that he fell backwards into it, but he couldn't stop the fire. Like, by this point, it is like, we will not see this. We'll see this two more times in American history. Mm-hmm. We will see this with Ulysses S. Grant after the Civil War, and we'll see with Eisenhower after World War II. But he is basically a national hero. Combined with the fact that everybody who's ever served under him is like, loves this him. Dude's awesome. Right. Like, people love this dude.
Right.
But he's ready. He's like, I'm going to enjoy the rest of my life on my land. I'm done. This is great. Like, he's just pumped. He's excited. At this point, he's in his 60s. He's 64 years old. He's done everything he's ever wanted to do. He's lived this awesome life. He grew up poor. He was born into a poor family that, his father did get land. It did have this, you know, it's very funny. If you ever read the book, The Good Earth, it very much follows that book. I know it has nothing to do with this, but like, And he's like, he has this plantation and he doesn't have to work. He's, you know, he has his military career. He's just like, dude, and he has this woman he loves. He's been married to for almost 50 years at this point.
How many kids do they have now at this point?
Six. Four kids. Two passed away. And he's just, this is awesome. I'm going to go live in Baton Rouge. I'm going to drink with my old army buddies. I'm going to have a good life. Yeah, so that lasts for literally 0 minutes. He gets almost nothing. People across the country in the North and South are asking him to run. And he's getting constant like pressure to run. So he eventually gets thrust into the political arena. He has no experience, and he hates not having any experience. But there are Americans...
When did he get malaria again?
Yeah, right now. So he ends up... a lot of prominent Americans are pushing for him to run. He's like, you know, he's a man of service. He's like, guys, I haven't voted. I've been a soldier.
That too, but we also learned like it's only recent that like real political campaigns have been starting. So like it seems a little bit late to be able to launch a political campaign and actually be able to carry an election, right?
Yeah. Oh no, absolutely. So he doesn't really know even what to do. He actually says he's like, I'm a soldier. I've been a soldier for 4 decades. That's what I know what to do. I've never had any civil office and I've never voted. What are you doing? He goes, and he went in. What's funny, he doesn't just like, oh, I don't know what I'm doing. He's very articulate about it. He goes, I have vague political beliefs. I don't even know what my political beliefs are. And he's very moderate. And people are confused on this because he's this Southerner and a slaveholder who was sympathetic to Southern interests. But before that, he was a nationalist who believed in Union preservation and just hated sectional division. And you'll see that during his presidency. And
also his hatred of Jefferson Davis.
Yeah, he does. Oh, God, does he hate Jefferson Davis? It is kind of funny because it's just like he called it and was right. Man. And he gets like he was just right. Like,
do you know how satisfying that is, too, to like to nail like the guy that everybody else likes? And then you're like, no, he's not cool. It's going to take about a year or two, but everyone's going to realize that you're a real
that guy sucks.
Piece of work. Yeah.
But he did state that he's not quote unquote ultra on slavery, that he opposed, and this is where it gets strange. He starts talking about, he opposed the extension of slavery to the Western territories if it would split the Union. And this is where it starts getting weird about his beliefs on slavery. He starts sounding a lot like Monroe. He starts sounding like an emancipator, and it's weird to start talking about a Southern slaveholder, sounded like an emancipator, doesn't believe it should expand. He thinks it will threaten the Union. And people are like, Zach, you know you have a bunch of slaves. He's like, yes. And they're like, what do you think in the long run? Like, it was kind of like, what do you think in the long run is going to happen? He's like, we won't put it above national unity. And they're like, that was not a glowing endorsement of you saying that people are going to be able to keep their slaves. He's like, all I'm saying is that we shouldn't put it above national unity. And people are like, I'm very confused by you right now, Mr. Guy, who I thought would be very much in my team. Oh, and the Southern slave owners would be very correct in assuming he was not going to be on their side. So 1848, early 1848. So again, we started the story in December of 1847. By early 1848, Taylor's clearly going to win the nomination. And it's almost like he doesn't even want to.
Dude, if he's pissing off the Southern voting bloc and he's still winning.
The Whigs love him, though, at this point.
Okay.
So we have a lot of correspondence from this time, and obviously Cypher Sox has done a good job kind of firing it. He's hesitant. He's ignorant. He talks about it openly. He's like, I don't know about this stuff. I don't know about these political issues. And he's like, can I just focus on being a plant, being a planter and like retired general? That'd be cool. And they're like,
No.
By 1848, he's going to win. Like by 1848, everybody knows it. Old, rough, and ready. He's just, they have the Whig convention.
Who's he running against?
I believe.
Polk got one. Polk only wanted one term. He was one term, and he said he was going to be done after that, right?
Yeah. Then he immediately died. Like a absolute.
And nobody was sad.
Dude, imagine going around and doing a victory tour, and then you die. Oh, that's who it was. It was Lewis Cass was a Democratic nominee. I always get that wrong.
Heard that name.
Dude, he baller picture. And it was Martin Van Buren was running against the Free Soil Party.
Oh, that's right. Martin Van Buren was kind of splitting things up a little still here.
Yeah, so he doesn't interesting fact, he doesn't win any of the free there's nobody wins more than 50% of the popular vote. It's just Zachary Taylor gets 47.3%, but it's a slacking electoral college. So mm-hmm. out of a possible 290 electoral college votes, he gets 163. So he wins by a good margin, right? Yeah. In the states that would be needed to swing these, Pennsylvania and New York are firm winning states.
No,
yeah. Cass was never winning those. So, you know, after the election, everybody kind of gets it. Like, they're like, okay, I don't want to call it a popular mandate. It's pretty damn close to a popular mandate. So he actually becomes the first president ever elected who didn't hold political office beforehand.
What?
And he was widely seen as a symbol of unity. A lot of Southerners, especially the portion of Southerners who didn't own slaves, he was a Southern hero. He was this general who was all rough and ready. And to the Northerners, he was seen as this very, though being a slaveholder, he was seen as this enlightened nationalist who wanted to keep the country together. He ends up coming up with this kind of, as we transition into his presidency, he gets elected and he's putting together his cabinet, and he doesn't really know how to put together a cabinet. And I'm sitting there going,
did we cover his platform already? Like, what he ran on?
Didn't really have a platform.
Weird.
Didn't really have a platform. Okay. His platform was kind of like national unity over everything else, and I will fight you if you disagree with me, which... Yeah.
Okay. All right. Sounded like what we needed at the time.
Yeah, honestly, like pretty solid move by this dude. Right. So he ends up, he doesn't really know how to form an administration, and he doesn't really know what to do. Because in his life, he's been in the military 40 years. You don't pick who your subordinate officers are, really. You just the people you have.
They just get assigned him.
They just get assigned to him. I think he would have taken that. I think if he was like, oh, he's just going to assign me them, I'll be happy.
He should have gone and made a deal with Henry Clay, right? I think that's what you're supposed to do.
Yeah. He actually got along pretty good with like Clay and Western, yeah. Those dudes. Yeah. Because they were like, oh, he's just he's not an ideologue. He's like the opposite of an ideologue.
Also, I'm guessing he probably put competent people in place eventually,
yes.
Right?
Yeah. So, yeah, he took no real strong public stances during the campaign besides his focus on unification. And throughout the time, his personal reputation remained as a unifier, as steady and honest. And they wanted this old, the press, there's actually a headline, not a headline, but there's one of the authors I read, said a lot of the headlines at the time where the public was eager for the mm-hmm. leadership of old Rough and Ready, that they wanted to be led by this man. He leaves Louisiana, sets in towards Washington, and he gets sworn to office on March 4th, 1849.
How long did that trip take?
It's wicked long. I want to say it was like 10 days. I'm not 100% sure on that. Like, it's the dates
that
are kind of weird
on
that.
That long.
but
yeah,
he's only in office for about a year before he passes away. We have another president who dies in office after essentially food poisoning. We are actually like really ironic, the opposite of William Henry Harrison. We kind of know what killed Zachary Taylor. Also, he was,
he wasn't the tomatoes, was he?
No, he was, that was Jefferson was the one that Jefferson everybody thought tomatoes were poisonous because they were eating them on lead plates.
On pewter, yeah.
Yeah. So he was celebrating July 4th in 1850, and he consumed a ton of cherries and milk.
Oh, that's right.
He was attending a fundraiser event to build the Washington Monument. He fell severely ill, basically developed gastroenteritis. Everybody thought he was going to be fine. And he even continued to work because he was like, oh, I've been sick a bunch of times. I'll keep working.
Right. It wasn't malaria.
Yeah. And what he ended up getting, ends up getting diagnosed with infectious diarrhea from cholera. It's cholera. It's 19. It's 18th century, 19th century. And this eventually develops into dysentery. He's in his 60s at this point.
Salmonella or something from like the milk.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it could have been a bunch of things. It could have been his weakened immune system from, fighting all those diseases.
From having malaria for his entire life.
Yeah, pretty much.
I was just looking up Louis Pasteur. I was trying to see when he figured out pasteurization.
1850s, 1860s.
He was born in 1822. He died in 1895, but I'm not sure when the pasteurization. I was trying to figure that out. I was wondering if that might have saved him.
Also had, also invented a vaccine for rabies after seeing his friend get bit by a dog and die when he was a kid.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, Louis Pasteur is a cool dude. So, you know, he does end up passing away in 1750, but so he's only in office for about 14 months. It's a busy 14 months. So.
Really?
Oh, yeah. It's interesting. Maybe not in action, but in what he set for a tone.
Okay.
So he gets inaugurated in March of 1849. His cabinet is primarily made up of Southern Whigs, but there's a good amount of Northerners in there too. It was a cabinet of competent people, mm-hmm. but it was a very fragile coalition inside of it. Okay. These were strong, headstrong men from all over the country who he prided his ability to have people who would speak honestly, directly, and avoided candor. Because that's how he liked his, that's how he taught his junior officers to talk to him. So he wanted people who, in most cases, you'd probably consider disrespectful if they were talking to the president that way.
Sounds like the way you, your relationship with your interns that you yeah. try to cultivate, right?
Yes, I want my interns to yell at me. I tell that to them all the time. by this point, Congress, remember, this is when they have the gag rule and stuff, that Congress is just completely in gridlock. So he went in there. He basically told his cabinet that they're basically gonna go fight Congress. Like, we need mm-hmm. to get them moving. They can't just keep being like, you're from the North, I'm from the South. I don't want to talk to you. And he's a very impatient man. Yeah.
Really?
And the funny thing about Taylor is that Taylor was an impatient man. He was a very patient man on the battlefield. He was very patient in this. He basically viewed Congress as a bunch of children that needed to work. If you're not working, you get out of the way. So when he gets out, obviously the conversation of statehood of Texas, New Mexico, and obviously California's a big one, obviously Compromise of 1850.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, didn't like they leave Texas like for him?
Yeah, yeah, basically he was the guy who had to deal with that going to the Union. Now, California, it was very interesting. So after Mexico cedes that territory to the U.S., Taylor actually urged California and New Mexico to not become territories and become states immediately and to make their own constitution because he said that would reduce the friction in Congress.
Trying to keep them from going automatically going as a slave state, basically?
Yeah, he said that would have caused it. That would have caused a greater discussion. And people were like, Taylor, it's because you want them to be a slave state. He was like, no, I don't want them to be a slave state. And like, why do anybody want them to be a slave state? He goes, I think that threatens the union. The stability of the union.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they were like, but you own slaves. He's like, yep. And this is when people are like, dude, you're an emancipator. They're looking at him. And he's like,
collecting slaves, like getting ready for the emancipation.
Yeah. He is one of the largest slave owners in the country at this point. He's probably the largest slave owner in Kentucky. And so this is messing with people a lot because they're like, what? They don't understand. And like everybody, dude, we're a decade away from the Civil War. Everybody sees this coming.
Yeah.
And the Senate is like, wait, but you're gonna tilt it. There was always this theory that as you tilt the Senate free or slave, that eventually you're gonna hit a tipping point where the Senate has enough control to fully
force the other side to adopt their views. Yeah.
But he went to Congress and insisted that Congress had no obligation to create, I'm reading this verbatim, he insisted to Congress that they had no obligation to create territorial governments designed to protect slavery and that states formed through popular sovereignty of their settlers should be admitted on their own terms.
God damn, I love this guy.
Dude, it is wild. Right? It's so the Northern Whigs are like, dude, what did you just say over there? And he's like, no, I just, popular sovereignty, it should go in there. The Northern Whigs are like, what? what's going on here? And so the Northerners are like, we like this guy, but now we really like this guy. We don't know what we didn't realize it. Like, because you elected one of the largest slaveholders in the country, and you're sitting there going like, he's actively saying that we should and he was very adamant about it. He was like, Senate should just be free. Like he was kind of open about that, but
I'm starting to worry that he might have been poisoned.
Yeah, right. Now my favorite one is. Yeah. During this period, there's this movement of that we start to see the true what becomes eventually this secession movement. But this isn't like how these have popped up previously throughout American history. This is the one that sustains until 1860s. But basically, a bunch of Southern leaders begin to openly discuss secession, or at least have a Southern convention to coordinate resistance. Taylor responds. He finds out about this. He responds to them privately in letters, but then publicly comes out and he goes, he declared that threats to disunion were unacceptable, whole stop. And he suggested in these letters that he wrote to these people and eventually became public, said, if that happens, I will personally lead troops from the front and suppress the rebellion, and that includes a convention. And the funniest part about it, and I love this, is nobody thought he was politically posturing. Nobody was like, oh, he's just saying that.
Right.
It wasn't Andrew Jackson saying, hey, Marshall, you come here and stop me with this army. No, he literally, people were like, the way he worded it, because again, he's not a pontificator. He's not a man of hyperbole. He's a 40-year military veteran.
Well, there's probably the exact plan of how he was going to do it, too. Here's my
invasion. Oh, he's probably pumped.
Right, yeah.
He was like, guys, I don't know about supply lines.
I'm going to show you everything. Here's the date.
I have some vague ideas about politics, but I have some real ideas about military action. That's definitely what he was like. He's probably excited. Yes. He's probably like, oh, I hope they have a convention. I'm going to go burn everything to the ground. This will be great. This will be a fun day for me.
This is what I'm good at.
But that was very intimidating because, A, they knew he literally was not capable of being funny about this.
Right.
And that he very clearly was like, I would love to command an army. And so he's like, I will use military force. And he sets a precedent here that Lincoln uses where he's like, it's the duty of the president to use military force to enforce national unity.
Interesting.
This was crazy to Southerners, to non-Whig Southerners. They were like, this is crazy. The president is threatening to come here and
force
lead an army
us
to attack us.
Stay in this group. Yeah.
And so a lot of these Southerners, they were expecting loyalty from this slave owner. And they weren't expecting some dude to be like, I view it as a constitutional duty that I have to defeat you in battle if you choose to threaten the existing legal order of the Union. That was the term he used.
Yeah.
And again, this isn't Jackson pumping his chest. This is literally a dude who's like, dude, this will be a blast. I'll go get my 6th Infantry. We'll go have a blast. It'll be a great weekend. Yeah, everybody, right. I'll catch malaria 3 times. It will just be a great time. But it gets even wilder. So in 1850, so this is shortly before he passes away, and or the same year he passed away, I should say.
Yeah.
But it's 1850, he passes away July 14th, mid-July of 1850, he passes away. And there ends up being this border dispute between Mexico, New Mexico, and Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, the federal government and the state of Texas are having this disagreement with the western boundary of Texas. Texas is claiming this sweeping portion of what is now western New Mexico. All the way to Santa Fe. So, Kyle, you're from that area. Think of how far Santa Fe is from the Texas border.
Yeah, that's quite a bit.
Yeah,
that's kind of most of New Mexico.
yeah, essentially New Mexico.
Yeah.
And so, the Texans are effectively annexing it, which the way Texans got Texas was going into Mexico and effectively annexing it.
Right.
And the Texans are kind of playing cutesy here, where they're just like, oh, you're not going to come and use military authority or anything like that. You're not going to order it. And so President Taylor sends a letter to the Texans. They're like, I want to make this very clear to you. If you threaten the sovereign border of the state of New Mexico, territory of New Mexico, I am sending federal troops to enforce the border.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we haven't done the Mexican-American War, but there's a very distinct language used in how he wrote that. Because Taylor basically started the Mexican-American War by marching troops to the border, to the Rio Grande border, and saying, this is the border. So he's basically saying, remember that thing I did where I overthrew an entire government? I overthrew an entire government. Do you want me to overthrow? State's an easy one. State's an easy one.
Last time I was on your side. This time I'm not going to be.
So basically, he's like, yeah. And it's... He's also, during this time period, talking about admitting California and New Mexico and all these states should effectively default be free states.
Right.
That there's no obligation for the union to protect slaves. So if we go back to what we talked about last week. Yeah, slave owners. Yes. Sorry, very important.
Very big very distinction.
Especially yeah. for Taylor. Very big distinction.
Yes.
This goes back to 15 years earlier, the Second Seminole War, where he refused to use the U.S. Army to capture freed slaves, to escape slaves. And he's doing the same thing. And
the writing was on the wall, right? I mean, like, if anybody had looked into his history, like, it should be pretty obvious that this is not the typical Jacksonian slave owner president.
So he ends up basically threatening Texas with all-out war. Congress doesn't know what the hell to do about this. They're like, can you do that? Like, can you fight a state? And he's like, absolutely. He goes, and
they have troops. My troops will line them up and have it out.
Yeah. And he said to them, he's like, everything comes after national unity. We are a nation. That is all that matters. Anything that threatens national unity can be met with military force. Full stop. Again, a precedent that goes through the Civil War. It's one of the few things we're going to be talking about this time period where it's a precedent that goes to the Civil War that's a good precedent. And the whole time, it's very funny because by this point, the Southerners are like, oh my God, what did we elect? What is this guy?
Right.
Like, this is like electing John Quincy Adams. What the hell happened? Like, we elected a guy.
The anthrax cherries.
Yeah, right. Like, we elected a guy who just like has this insane moral compass. That it's just the union goes before all else, to the point where he's even like the union goes before even his right to own slaves. And they're just like, oh my God, is the largest slaveholder in Kentucky an emancipator? When did that happen? What a wild reality right. to live in. But the thing that really bothered, think of it, you have a very divisive Congress right now. And the thing that made Taylor hard to vilify was that he was not an ideologue.
Right,
he had no ideological convictions. He was a general. If the plan doesn't work, you find a new plan. You don't die with the plan. Right. And the public loves this dude. They're like, this is exactly what we voted for. We got this is exactly what we voted for. Loved it. They're like, this is like no notes. We elected a general who's like, here's the options.
Next 3 years are gonna rule.
Yeah. I'm going to fight you. It's like, I would like to discuss this action. Great. You can discuss it with my fists.
First fight, then we can talk.
There's a little bit of foreign policy Taylor has during this time.
Yeah.
His foreign policy was always very much restraint. He ran his foreign policy the same way he ran his frontier forts. It was restraint. It was focused on consolidation, not expansion. He loved expansion rhetoric. It was going through the country right now, especially people wanting to go into Cuba and going into Central America. But his idea of expansionism was not march an army across a border, take what you want, which is ironic compared to the Mexican-American War. Right. But he didn't believe that as a president. He believed that we need to avoid foreign entanglements. He actually used a specific – he didn't say foreign entanglements. Let me rephrase that. He said aggressive foreign entanglements. He never really offered anything against defensive foreign entanglements. He just like aggressive ones. Again, the country, it helps when you're a very prominent military mind because the country's like, I like aggressive expansionists, but the dude in office is also a very competent general who's telling me to calm down.
No,
maybe I'll listen to that. That guy might actually know what he's talking about.
I think he's got a plan. Let's just see what he's. Let's let him handle things for a little bit here.
He discouraged. So there used to be these things called filibustering expeditions, where basically Americans would go to different like Caribbean islands and try and seize them in the Native America. And he was like, "Stop doing that!" What's great? He was like, he'd be like, "Stop doing that!" And people would be like, "Oh." Is it because you have this ideology about blah, blah, blah? He's like, no, because it's really hard to hold forts in like the middle of nowhere. Like, trust me, you need good supply lines. You putting a flag in some Caribbean island is not going to be us. We're not going to be able to like supply that with true. Like, and people are like, oh, you're not. Wait, this is an ideological argument. It's like, no, I'm beating with the fact that I can't supply that. So who cares?
We have like this whole Monroe Doctrine too, where we're not supposed to interfere with the politics of like these other countries in our hemisphere.
One of the coolest things is that. again, this is a guy who handedly was very aggressive in defeating the Mexicans in the Mexican-American War. But one of the first things he did when he got in office is he got together with Great Britain and Mexico and almost immediately cooled tensions after the war.
Yeah.
And he was basically like, hey, we're done. Like, and it, dude, you got to look at it this way. He's a guy being like, I'm trying to enforce my own borders, and I'm yelling at the people, filibustering to go try and capture Caribbean islands. He's right. Like, I don't want any of that. That's not official U.S. policy. That's crazy. I'm not even an expansionist. I'm like procedural. Like, if the West expands because of population growth and we maintain treaties, cool. Here's my 40-year military history of being like, really not wanting to fight people, except when I do have to fight people, I tend to just completely destroy them. Like, I don't like any of this. I want to drink and sleep on a cot, 2 inches above the mud. Like, that's and catch malaria. Those are, my three things I like.
Right.
He's like, making children, catching malaria. Those are the two things I like to do. By this point, he believes the United States, should really stabilize its territories. He sees the Civil War coming, by the way. It's clear. Yeah. Like, he's like, guys, we're going to stop expanding because, we're probably about to fight each other. And somebody's like, yeah, probably because of you. You got voted in because they thought you were pro-slave, and now you're out here threatening to fight slave owners. It's like, yeah. he just didn't believe that anything should be beyond national unity.
Yeah.
One other, thing I want to talk about is his kind of, the patronage of his patronage, right? Like, the idea of how he worked with Congress, how he worked with individuals. So Clay Webster and a lot of the other congressional leaders, they introduced this is kind of the only major congressional thing that it was interesting to talk about. They introduced the omnibus bill that would become the Compromise of 1850, the one that admits California to the Union. And they're basically trying to resolve territorial disputes, slavery disputes. They're trying to do everything in a single package. It was rough. Taylor opposed he straight up opposed it. He was like, no, just admit California's a free state. They were like, you're picking the most controversial way to do this. What are you doing?
Right.
He was like, just immediately as a free state. Let local government decide how it wants to run itself afterwards. They're like, you can't have local government decide the slave question. And he's like, yeah, I know. So you're saying admit it as a slave state? He's like, no. I'm saying admit it I'm saying admit it as a free state, and then local government can deal with the charters. And he was like, this is going to be huge, hard to pass in Congress. So they come to him. So these are Whigs. They come to him. They're like, hey, do you support this, the omnibus, right. do you support the mid ground? And he's like, no, I said what I said. It should be a free state. And they're like, yeah, but nobody's gonna vote for that. He's like, oh, that's cool. Yeah, that's my opinion. Do what you want with it. And Henry Clay's like, we're on the same team. We're both Whigs. And he's like, yeah, that's cool. So free state. Like, we'll just do a free state. He just was not indignant, but it was just like, I don't see how you don't see my point of view.
What are you not understanding?
But yeah, it is funny. He did have a lack of political experience, and that kind of left him vulnerable sometimes because he didn't really understand the different factions. So that's what Henry Clay, brilliant man, but I think I pissed off Henry Clay. I don't think he fully understood
right
what Henry Clay was trying to get. If you want other stuff passed, we have to figure this out. And
that's just Clay not being a very good teacher. You got to be able to explain the reason for why you want your student to do stuff.
So he absolutely hated this idea of party machines. He considered them liabilities. He hated patronage. He didn't understand you scratch my back, I scratch yours for votes. He was just like, no, either you have the right idea or not. And it's because he was just known for this man who had this huge amount of personal integrity, was widely respected. And he was like, well, if I have a good reputation and I'm honest and straightforward, also I'm a great military leader, why do I have to lie about my position, either out your stuff or not? And, at the end, he was this incredibly admired politician, incredibly admired man. And as we talked about earlier, he wouldn't be able to enjoy his legacy. He wouldn't be able to enjoy this, what could have been set out to be an incredibly successful presidency. And because on July 4th, 1850, celebrating the birth of the United States, he contracts cholera, eventually develops into dysentery, and despite treatments, which weren't really effective treatments at the time, he would pass away on July 9th. And he would pass away at kind of the beginning of the exponential growth of sectional tensions. and unfortunately leave Millard Fillmore to deal with it. And I certainly, we don't want to give away too much of Millard Fillmore's discussion, but he was not made of the same composite that Zachary Taylor was made of. But there it is, America's first and only Zach presidency.
If only George Washington hadn't lied about chopping down those cherry trees. Are you ready to do some POTUS rankings for Mr. Taylor?
Because absolutely.
I gotta say, as we've been doing this episode, I just keep hearing that score ticking up higher and higher in my head. As everyone should know by now, we do this on our patented POTUS ranking system, which goes through the political influence, overall governance, transformational leadership, understanding of public needs, and strategic vision. So I'll let you lead us off, Eric, with the political influence, president's ability to shape the landscape, including their impact on party dynamics, legislative agendas, and long-term political shifts.
I think, and I'm going to, this sounds bad, but I think it's what Major Taylor, because that's what he liked to be called, Major Taylor Moore. I think it's a very low ranking.
Yep. Yeah, this is his weakest mark, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a one. And that's nothing against him. I think you'd be proud to have a one in that category.
I know, right?
I don't have a political agenda. You're the president. Yeah, I don't have a political agenda. My political agenda is the country stays together or I fight you. It's like, that's a pretty good political agenda.
Overall governance, then? The effectiveness of this administration implementing policies, managing bureaucracy, and maintaining stability and governance.
His time at president, no, it was good, dude. He was an effective leader. He hired a very good cabinet that may have been hard to keep together, but he was a good leader. He at the end of the day, it's like you had the Compromise of 1850. Like that did happen. So it's very hard to be.
What about his opposition or the I guess unwillingness to do much to help with that omnibus bill? I mean, he could have helped them craft something that had a better chance of passing, right?
Yes, but it did eventually pass. Like, we did eventually get the Compromise of 1850. And it was California's a free state. And it did establish popular sovereignty, which is kind of what he was
kind of got everything he wanted. Okay, all right. I mean, that's...
And most importantly, New Mexico was allowed to become a state.
Can we bump up his political influence a little bit more? Because it seems like he kind of got everything he wanted.
Yeah, we'll bump that up to two. But I think this one's probably like a 5.5 or 6.
Five and a half or six? Which one do you want?
Let's do six, because I like this guy.
I do too, man. He might end up on the...
I would love to see what happened if he lived.
I have a
feeling he probably wouldn't have done
Actually,
I think he's a Van Buren.
I was actually wondering. I was thinking
Van
about...
Van Buren Monroe.
As we were talking through this, it was making me wonder if the Civil War would have waited till Lincoln if he had served out his full term, because it really sounded like he was putting us on the course to solve the problem now.
He was going to solve the problem now, and it was going to be him just attacking people. Like, that was going to be, I got a military and you don't. The South wouldn't have been able to fill the military.
How much quicker would that war have been, I wonder, too?
A lot shorter. It would have been very over. you broke all our stuff. Yes.
All right, transformational leadership then. Ability to enact significant change or reforms that alter the course of history. Did they address pressing societal issues and implement lasting change?
I got to say it's a 6, and I got to say that because the Compromise of 1850 set up popular sovereignty, and because he stuck to his guns and showed executive enforcement and established the idea that it's the obligation of the nation, it's the obligation of the federal government to enforce national unity. I mean, if that's not calling the Civil War a decade ahead of time and
setting a precedent for quite some time then about national unity.
Yeah, I gotta say it's a 6. He saw that coming.
I'll give you that. Understanding of public needs. How well do you understand and respond to the needs and concerns of the American public? Did he engage with citizens and address their priorities effectively? Oh man, this is
he didn't really. He didn't. I'm going to say this. It's you not don't that think, he didn't care.
You don't think
just,
he
was,
it was like,
never an option. He just never. It wasn't what the nation was doing at the time.
I look at it the way he was with his troops as a general who fully understands the needs of his troops. Like, how does he not carry that over to his presidential?
Oh, I don't think he disregarded the need of the people. I just think the need of the people. It wasn't like we were in an economic recession. It wasn't like we were in this or that. There wasn't this big popular uprising moving.
No, but there was a looming question about the thing that was about to tear the whole nation in half.
Oh, okay, Kyle. So this is, hold on. This is, I like your idea. Give me a quick one on this one.
Okay.
So like, Here's what I like your idea a lot. Are you saying that we should interpret this question based on like how he react, even if the half of the people didn't agree with him,
yeah,
that he was acting based on what was clearly the most pressing issue at the time?
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, look, if okay, I think when we get to someone like Mr. H.W. Bush and the no new taxes, this is going to be one of those ones where he understands what is needed, but the public is going to eviscerate him for it.
Yeah, like, no offense, but he will be on Mount Rushmore. George H.W. Bush, I'll just give him a max score for everything.
Whatever we have to do.
Yes, you'll just be like, Eric, you have him ranked above Abraham Lincoln. It's like, honestly, bet. So yeah, I want to
do better, Abraham.
Then. Yeah, honestly.
Yeah, George Bush never suspended habeas corpus.
Yeah,
I'm 5 for understanding public needs. I think that's fair. I think that's good. I like that. All right. Strategic vision then, clarity and ambition of his vision for the country. Did he have a forward thinking approach that guided their decisions, inspired hope for the future?
Yeah.
He didn't really have a platform though. Like,
but he was like, stop filibustering and like just taking land and
strategic. Oh, yeah. Okay.
He cooled down tensions with our two neighbors, Britain and Mexico, after invading one of the countries.
That's
and
pretty
then he
solid.
Was like, yeah, he's like, oh, by the way, dudes, like, we're going to have a civil war. Hey, maybe if the South puts together a convention, we should just go mess up everything. There was a Southern Convention of Secession. Abraham Lincoln didn't roll troops down there and break it up. You tell me, and I love Lincoln, my favorite president, you tell me Zachary Taylor's in office and he hears that some people getting together and putting, he's like, cool, can I come? Can I bring the 6th Infantry and the 7th Infantry? And honestly, I got some Seminoles on my side, too. Turns out like they're actually pretty close.
Chief Wilcox's been looking for something to do.
Yeah. That'd be weird to be rolled up with Seminoles. It's like, oh, that's wild. Oh, like, we're wrong.
You got everybody he's ever fought with has showed up with them.
It's like, oh, dude, we're kind of interested in this discussion, too. Yeah, no, he saw it coming. Like, yeah. No, I'm giving him a 6 for it. Like, that, it 6? Is wild as forward looking at.
Oh, man, he's got a good score here. 18 plus 5 plus 25. Not quite Mount Rushmore material for us, but that's pretty dang close.
Dude, yeah, he's...
That's pretty solid. Actually, that might be Mount Rushmore. 129. It's close. It'll be close.
Yeah. I don't know if I'd call him a Mount Rushmore president at this point, but damn, is he interesting? He is. He's a weird cat.
He's one of my new favorites, I think. I gotta say. He's everything I hoped Harrison would be.
Yeah, I mean, no, and they're definitely cut from the same cloth. And obviously, right. Taylor's right. A huge fan of Harrison. I do find something funny here. I believe if you look at all the presidents up to Taylor, he is literally, it's just him and John Quincy Adams, who was like, guys, I think we're going to have to fight each other. Like, I think that,
right.
Like, not the joking sectionalism way. Like, where they're like, oh, I don't like the North, I don't like the South. I think they were like, guys, I'm just like, I'm not talking like we don't like each other, we'll figure it out. I think the only way this ends is if we fight each other. Like, I think that's the only way.
Guys, I need to get, like, New York, like, manufacturing some rifles. I have a feeling we're going to need them soon.
Yeah. And then, like, Zachary Taylor, I believe he owned the most slaves of any president ever.
That's crazy to me.
Is that weird? Because then he was also wanted to flip the Senate free, which is crazy.
But I mean, but like, as we talked about, like, the reason why he had so many is because he bought entire families. He's just he did not want to break up families. He was buying entire families at the auctions just to, for what reason?
So crazy, one crazy thing just to throw out the end here, and I didn't really bring this up during the discussion because it became like it's not really about, it's less about Taylor and more just about the time he was in. So part of that, I don't want to say I'm speculating, but I'm speculating just a little bit. And I think this would have got cleared up a little more. Since we're after the ratings, we can be a lot more opinionated for a quick second.
Right, yeah.
Taylor, there is a belief among, I would say, a lot of people who are far smarter than I in research this, that the reason Mr. Taylor opposed the omnibus bill, that became a compromise of 1850, was not because of the discussion on slave or non-slave states. He believed that they should be a free state. And he was unrelenting in that belief. That was not something he was compromising on. Hmm. He didn't hate the idea of popular sovereignty for non-slave questions. So he was okay with that. He liked the establishment because there was the Compromise of 1850 had a bunch of parts to it. He did like the establishment of the Utah-New Mexico territories. He thought that was good. Obviously, he was a very big fan of the New Mexico territories. He was ready to fight the Texans on it.
Mm-hmm.
The Compromise of 1850 also ended interstate slave trade in Washington. So, like, now D.C.'s effectively, it has slaves, but you can't trade more slaves in there. It included a stricter interpretation of the Fugitive Slave Act.
Mm-hmm.
And he did not. I personally think he had a serious issue with the Fugitive Slave
Act. You think that's what it was?
Because basically what the Fugitive Slave Act required was that officials...
I'm sorry, was this the one where, like, if you saw a federal or fugitive, you had to capture and effect their return?
Yep.
Yeah, and as somebody, as we saw, learned from the Seminole Wars, like, he did not believe in that.
Yeah. I think that's why he didn't do it, because it required both citizens and federal officials in free states to assist in the capture and return of enslaved people.
That seemed completely anti anything he was about, yeah.
Yeah. So, like, when I was doing the research for this, I couldn't really figure out why he was so anti-omnibus, and he never really articulated it to Clay. He was just kind of like, his big thing was, like, California should be, you know, he kind of almost positioned it like California should be a free state because all states should be free state, and us even discussing whether mm-hmm. a state should be a slave state or free state, stupid. Like, but then everybody's like, popular sovereignty. He's like, yes, popular sovereignty right. on literally everything else besides the slave question. Because that should be a no.
Besides on the thing that half the people that you're voting on whether or not you can own are not allowed to vote in. Like, there's a problem there, right?
And I'm not going to lie. I would have loved – that's a cool what-if history.
Oh, man, right?
I wonder if Taylor would have enforced it. Because it's federal officials had to enforce the Fugitive Slave Act.
I bet you he vetoes that.
I bet he vetoes. Well, you know, he died during the debate, right? But I often wonder if he would have not enforced. If it passed and say they overrode his veto and they passed it, I don't think he would have enforced it.
No.
I think he would just be like, I think he would have given the middle finger to it.
Ask the Supreme Court to take it up for him.
I think one of my favorite things to do, Kyle, is introduce people to not their first favorite president. But, you know, maybe they're somebody to pick. You know what? Actually, I really like Zach Taylor. I'm surprised Zach was a good president.
So this is a president that I knew nothing about when we started this project. And now we're walking away with this. And I really do think this is becoming one of my, probably not my favorite president, like you said, but this is in my top five now. I guarantee you that. So join us next week. Now that we've gotten through Mr. Taylor's presidency here, you should finally be able to get through that Mexican-American War from start to finish, uninterrupted.
Yes.
So if you want to help pass the time, you can jump in the comments. Tell us how you would defend Mexico if you found yourself back in 1846. And if you wanted to demand an apology or correction, you can email us at buckstartsherepodcast@gmail.com. Raise those thumbs and subscribe on your way out the door. Make sure you visit the website to stay up to date. We'll see everybody next week.
See you.
Produced by China Shop Productions.